Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Michael Faraday was no stranger to lightning bolt moments of inspiration. In his basement laboratory, underneath the Royal Institution in Albemarle Street in London, Faraday was the right person at the right time, in the right place to be struck repeatedly by lightning bolt moments. Lightning bolt moments that would change history. Hello and welcome to Patented. It's a podcast about the history of inventions with me, Dallas Campbell. Thank you very much for your company. A warm welcome to you. Today, I'm going to be talking about a giant in the annals of the history of science and innovation, Michael Faraday. On September the 3rd, 1821, Michael Faraday dangled a live wire into a cup filled with mercury with a magnet at its centre. The wire rotated endlessly around the magnet. Electrical energy was being converted into mechanical energy using electromagnetic forces. And lo, the electric motor was born. The next lightning bolt struck 10 years later, in 1831. This time, Faraday wanted to reverse the process to see if a magnetic field could create an electric current. And he began with an odd-looking thing, an iron ring covered in cloth and wire that looked like something from, I don't know, an Egyptian tomb. But it proved that it was possible to create electricity from a magnetic field. He called this electromagnetic induction and refined the experiment until he had a device that turned a magnet moving back and forth into electricity. And lo, all of our modern power plants were essentially born. Faraday's discoveries didn't appear out of a clear blue sky. There was a billowing cloud of ideas about the nature of electricity and magnetism that had been building all over Europe ever since a Danish philosopher had realised there was a connection between the two. A deeply religious man, Faraday saw magnetic fields as physical objects and reasoned that all of reality was in fact made up of lines of force, that there was a single God-given force behind all things. Here to help tell the story of this giant of science and innovation is Frank James, editor of Michael Faraday's correspondence and the author of the book Michael Faraday, A Very Brief Introduction. Here is an even briefer one. Enjoy. Welcome to the show, Frank. Nice to see you.
Good to be here, yes.
We're here to talk about Michael Faraday. I've been thinking about where to start with this because it's a big, you know, he's a giant in the annals and the history of science. I thought what we'd do is we'd start, maybe you could take us on a bit of a tour on a specific day of Faraday's life. And then we'll go back in time. We'll talk a little bit about who he was and where he came from. But I thought we would talk about September the 3rd, 1821. He got up, and then what?
He's newly married at that point and had accommodation on the second floor of the Royal Institution. So that morning he would have gone down stairs, probably to his study on the first floor to begin with, and then down to the laboratory in the basement. Now, at that time, Faraday was beginning, or had been working for a review article on the work, the huge amount of work that had stemmed from Hans Christian Ørsted's discovery of electromagnetism a year or so before. What Ørsted had discovered was that if you had a compass needle in the vicinity of a wire carrying electric current, the needle was deflected.
Right.
The phenomenon was called electromagnetism.
Just remind us who Ørsted was, because I always think Faraday invented electromagnetism.
Ørsted was a very famous Danish natural philosopher who worked in Copenhagen, who believed in the fundamental unity of nature. And so Ørsted's paper is perhaps the last, it's only a four-page paper, it's a very short paper. It's possibly the last major paper on natural philosophy written in Latin, and it was quickly translated into the standard scientific languages, English, French, German, and so on.
I think we've gone downhill since we stopped publishing in Latin. I think that's been the slow slide. If you ask me, I think we should go back to that.
Well, yes. But the translating it into the standard European languages didn't actually help too much because of the paper was infused with Ørsted's natural philosophical commitments and so forth. So it was actually really rather unclear what he'd actually done, other than he managed to make a compass needle deflect.
But Faraday had read this and he was intrigued by it, or what was the...
And what happened was that all over Europe, men of science started working on this wonderful new phenomenon because they realised it was something important. So you had people like Berzelius in Stockholm, the De La Rives in Geneva, Ampère in Paris, and lots of other people working on this phenomenon and producing probably about 20 or so papers on electromagnetism in the year immediately following Ørsted's publication. And so Faraday spent the summer of 1821 reading through all these papers and found the only way he could make sense of what he was reading was to try and repeat the experiments described in all those papers.
Brings us to our date. Okay, so he's in his workshop or laboratory or work area. What happens? What does he come up with? What does he notice?
So what he does that day, which he hasn't done before, is to take a compass needle and move it around a wire, a vertical wire, carrying current electricity. He both observes and also feels, because Faraday's a very tactile person, that going around the electric wire are circles of force. And that is a really, really key observation, because until that moment, the assumption always was, going right back to Newton's Principia of 1687, that forces acted in a straight line.
Straight line, yeah.
And, I mean, Faraday found that these were actually circular forces. And so what Faraday did was, having realised that somehow electric force was circular in nature, the question was, how do you realise that? Now, he's convinced himself of the reality of those forces around an electric wire. And by implication, there's also circular forces around magnetism. And the first thing he does is to bend the wire with a little semicircular hoop in the middle of it. So instead of a straight wire, you've got a wire with a semicircle in the middle. And what he does then is to place that wire hung from a connector at the top, place that wire into a bowl of mercury, and then chase that wire, I can't think of a better word, around with a magnet. And he found the wire moved away from the magnet.
In a rotation.
And then, getting a bit tired of having to chase this wire around by himself, he had the idea that if you put the wire in the center of the mercury and hung the wire into the mercury, the wire would rotate continuously about the magnet, which is precisely what he did, and that's electromagnetic rotations, and it's a really, really tiny, I mean, it's not more than half an inch by half an inch drawing of that device in the bottom left-hand corner of his notebook.
So he's keeping a notebook of all the things he does.
Faraday's note-keeping practices are quite extraordinary, both in their intricacy and in their volume. I mean, he numbers every paragraph, and by the time he finishes his notebook in 1862, he's got to paragraph 16,041. I mean, that's...
I've got that amount of tabs open on my computer. That's my slightly chaotic.
I mean, the point of keeping a laboratory notebook is so that you can then go back upstairs, having done the experiment, go back upstairs to your study and write the paper. So when Faraday has made this sort of key observation, he goes back up to his first floor study and starts writing his paper. That brings in all sorts of other things that simply are not in the laboratory notebook. And in particular, it brings in the extraordinary observation that this is circular motion. Forces are acting. And that is important because of the way it suggests that Newtonian physics, which has been the dominant British view of physics for more than 100 years, is missing something. This is really important for Faraday. Now, Faraday did not go to university. Had he gone to Cambridge, the home of English Newtonianism, he would never in 1,000 years have dreamt up the idea of forces acting in circles, because he had been so thoroughly inculcated into the Newtonian view of forces only acting in straight lines, and if something goes in a curve, it's because another force in a straight line is affecting it. So that's why the planets going around the sun go around the sun. They're not naturally following.
They're in a straight line, but...
They're going in a straight line, but the sun's gravitational force is pulling them into their elliptical orbits. What Faraday has found is really rather different. And this has very important implications for Newtonian theory. It also has very important implications for mathematics, because in the following 2 years, Faraday conducts a firm but polite correspondence with André Marie-Ampère in Paris, who's the sort of French equivalent of Faraday in many ways. Basically, what Ampère had done after Oersted's work was to mathematize theory of electromagnetism, and he claims to have completely mathematized all aspects of electromagnetic theory.
When you say mathematize, you mean describing the phenomena using
Describing
math.
It in Newtonian terms. And what Faraday says quite clearly is that if your theory, Ampère, had been so good, it should have predicted this phenomena. It didn't. Therefore, your theory is no good. Ampère never really recovered from that attack, basically, on his theoretical work.
I just want to go back, Frank, if that's okay, to this idea of circular forces and why that is so radical and so important from a sort of practical point of view. Because the idea of I suppose of the unification of electricity and magnetism, and the idea you can have a wire spinning around a magnet, is a pretty fundamental idea, because it's obviously it's the birth of the electric motor.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, did Faraday realize that this was something utterly revolutionary? You know, we need to rewrite Newton, rewrite the science books.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, certainly realised all of that, yeah.
Did he run down Albemarle Street in London naked shouting Eureka?
Yes, I know. I mean, from a physics point of view, I mean, Faraday realised he'd made a really important... I mean, that's the whole point of his correspondence with Ampère. He was telling Ampère that Ampère's Newtonian analysis of electromagnetism was wrong, basically. That's a sort of good illustration that Faraday knew perfectly well what the stakes were.
I'm just trying to get that slightly kind of mystical sense of the relationship between electricity and magnetism, which weren't at that we knew about electricity and we knew about magnetism, but this sudden sort of relationship coming together. What did his lab look like? What was the sort of equipment he was doing to try and understand this?
A later visitor, Hermann Helmholtz, visiting Faraday in the 1850s, wrote to his wife saying that Faraday's laboratory is just comprised equipment of the most simple bits of wood and iron and steel, but with which Helmholtz said he made the most remarkable discoveries. Now, that's not entirely accurate, but I mean, that's the sort of impression. Interestingly enough, Faraday and others tend to describe it as the workshop rather than the laboratory. a lot of experimentation was actually done in domestic spaces. And so this is a sort of extension of domestic spaces. Perhaps a kitchen area might be quite similar. So it's that sort of bifurcation into a space which is solely devoted to experimentation is still a bit of a way off. I mean, must remember in the early 1852, George Stokes discovered fluorescence in his hallway, in his house in Lensfield Cottage in Cambridge. So even by the 1850s,
yes,
work was still being done in a domestic context.
So I suppose in Faraday's day, we didn't have the idea of professional scientists. Professional scientists didn't exist in the way that we would think professional scientists existed. They were, as you say, natural philosophers, gentlemen of science. There was an amateurism about it.
Not sure I'm happy with the word amateurism, I have to say.
I don't mean amateurism in a pejorative sense. I mean it in that people with other, they might have other professions. It wasn't you're being paid by to do science.
No, I mean, when I wrote my biography of Faraday a few years ago, I counted up the number of people paid for doing science on these islands and only just got it into just above 100. And that includes medical professors in Scotland and in Ireland and so on. I mean, what's really strange about Faraday's decision to become a natural philosopher, having spent 7 years learning the trade of bookbinding, is that as a sort of working class lad, he was joining a group of people who did science, most of whom weren't actually paid, most of whom were Anglican priests, doctors, Navy and Army officers, and so on. So it's a really peculiar decision of Faraday's in 1812 to decide that he doesn't want to do bookbinding, which would be given a safe career, but embark on this weird idea of going into science.
I like it, though. It's sort of running away to join the circus. People who run away to join the circus don't have things to fall back on. The circus doesn't want you if you've got other things. They like that free spirit of people who are going to go, yes, this is what I want to do, to hell with bookbinding. And presumably he'd married into money, or I think his wife was relatively well off.
They were both Sandemanians, a very small dissenting sect of literalist Christianity with a distinct neo-Calvinist approach. He wasn't particularly wealthy. Well, he wasn't wealthy at all, actually. Just he had to earn an income. That's why his decision to go into science is so strange.
And how much of that do you think was due to his religious beliefs? Was he trying to understand God's work? Do you think that was a motivating...
All of Faraday's work is directly towards understanding the world that God had created. And in using the laws of nature, which God had written to the universe at the beginning, to benefit humankind. And Faraday is very, very clear on that. Whatever Faraday was doing, experimenting in his basement laboratory, writing his papers and research notebooks up on the first floor, he were all directed towards understanding the laws of nature that God had written into the universe. The word law, by the way, occurs almost exactly the same number of times in the Bible as it does in Faraday's writings. Today's useless fact.
We'll be back after this short break.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on my podcast, Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I try to make sense of everything that baffled our early modern ancestors. Like, what do you do with your waste?
If you put your dunghill up against your neighbour's wall, you're going to cause rising damp.
Would Henry VIII ever consider executing his wife, the Queen of England, Anne Boleyn?
I'm not even sure if the Boleyns took it seriously, because why would they have any reason to suspect Henry VIII would really get rid of his queen?
And why do men grow beards?
During puberty, the male body heats up and a smoke rises in the body, pushes out the hair in the face. So the beard is actually a form of excrement.
In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm just trying to get that slightly kind of mystical sense of the relationship between electricity and magnetism, which weren't, we knew about electricity and we knew about magnetism, but this sudden sort of relationship coming together, and 10 years later, the process being reversed, whereby suddenly you had induction, where you could actually create electricity by doing a similar thing. And sort of what happened in that time period? So he's invented the electric motor, then what?
Well, he publishes the result, has this correspondence with Ampère, and then not very much for another 8 or 9 years because he's far too busy doing other things. I mean, it's quite clear from various comments in his notebooks that he's still really interested in electromagnetism, but he doesn't have time to work on the phenomenon. He's too busy making optical glass for Bord Longitude. He's the first secretary of the Athenaeum Club. He's involved in the project to protect the copper bottoms of Royal Navy vessels.
It's just such a massive thing, the electromagnetism. It's odd that it would just be sort of parked as while he had to do other things.
But it goes back to what you were saying earlier, that there was no such thing as a professional class of scientists who were there to spend their time doing this sort of thing. That's the point. That class doesn't exist. There's nobody around who's going to do that sort of work. And Faraday was an employee of the RI. He was not a free agent. So he had to do all these other things. And one thing that science takes is time. So he is always looking out for the opportunity to do research. But it's not until 1831 that he's able to return to a decent research agenda in his basement laboratory.
So 1821, he invents the principles of the electromotor. There are no practical benefits. It's not like people suddenly go rushing out building things.
No, I mean, you don't get practical electric motors until sort of the 1830s.
Yeah, and so you mentioned that he's doing his other work during this time. Maybe this is a good point just to explain what the RI actually is for those who don't know. We've mentioned it a lot, the fact that he's based there, he lives there, he works there. What is the Royal Institution and how is it different from the Royal Society?
Right. How long is this podcast supposed to be?
Half an hour.
The Royal Institution was founded in 1799 with the intention of providing scientific lectures to the aristocracy and the upper middle class. Membership was very expensive, it was 50 guineas, which is a hell of a lot of money. And it acquired very early on 21 Old Mile Street.
Still there.
It went through a number of financial crises.
Still there.
And it had its, arguably its luckiest break when in 1801 Humphrey Davy was appointed there. And it's Davy who creates the reputation of the Royal Institution as a place to go to first-rate scientific lectures, as a place where the state can turn to ask for scientific advice. But it's also Davy who brings in the research agenda. Research had never been intended to be one of the Royal Institution's activities. He brought that agenda in, and because he then developed a coherent theory of electrochemistry, discovered sodium and potassium, among other chemical elements, and in 1815 invented, with Faraday's help, one has to say, the miner's safety lamp, that put the Royal Institution firmly on the map. And Faraday learned a very valuable lesson there about the practical application of science.
And it's worth pointing out that Faraday had been to the Royal Institution and seen Davy lecture, and that was the kind of why he ended up there.
Yeah, Faraday attended Humphrey Davy's last four lectures, and indeed he took a detailed set of notes and gave them to Davy, asking Davy for a job in science, and after a fairly complex and highly contingent set of circumstances, Faraday was appointed there in the spring of 1813. And the reason why they were Davy's last lectures was because he was about to marry an extremely wealthy heiress called Jane of Priest.
That's the secret if you're a natural philosopher with limited income, is marry someone rich.
Jamie wrote when he got married to his brother that he was now able to retire from being professor of chemistry at the Royal Institution at the age of 33, and he'd now be able to devote his time to research. I mean, in your dreams, what else to say?
Anyway, so Faraday ended up working at the Royal Institution. Let's jump forward 10 years. So 1821, he discovers this movement, the sort of circular forces. Forces don't travel necessarily in straight lines. They can be circular. The electric motor is, in inverted commas, invented and noted in his book with a little drawing. 10 years later, the reverse happens, this idea of inductions. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that came to be and the results of that, what it meant for society. What do we mean by induction? Actually, maybe we should just define what we mean by...
In Faraday's terms, this is most neatly encapsulated when he says some point in 1825 or 1826, make electricity from magnetism. That's basically what induction is, to get electrical force out from magnetism. And on the 29th of August, 1831, he comes into his laboratory having made an induction ring, and I'll come back to that in a minute, and just writes in his laboratory notebook, experiments on the production of electricity from magnetism, etc., etc. Well, that is not the most helpful opening phrase in a laboratory notebook that one can imagine. What Faraday had done was he'd taken a soft iron ring, 4 or 5 inches in diameter, and wound on opposite sides 2 coils of wire. What you've basically got is 2 semicircles of electromagnets facing each other, but they're on one ring. There was no insulated wire at that time, so you had to insulate wire. So as you pushed and pulled the wire in out of the ring, you had to insulate it. Having made this ring, he comes into the laboratory at the end of August and passes an electric current through 1 coil. And when he does that, he gets an electric current on the other side. That is electromagnetic induction. That is a generation of electrical force via magnetism. And over the next 6 or 7 weeks, he works on these ideas and eventually gets a cylinder, which he wraps again with wire, sticks a galvanometer on the wire, pushes the magnet in and out of the coil, and you get an alternating current. And that's the world's first electric generator.
I have to say, I've done that live on stage in the Royal Institution. I did that very experiment with Brian Cox, actually. We were doing something, I can't remember what we were doing, the science of Doctor Who, I remember. And we did that. We had a demonstration, you push in and out, and lo and behold, you get an electric current.
And all electricity power stations, apart from those which are solar powered, produce electricity in that way, no matter what the primary source of energy is, coal, oil, nuclear.
This is the thing that I think is still counterintuitive. You know, we all energy, all power is generated. Well, not all. You mentioned solar, but this idea of rubbing magnets over copper wire generates electricity, and how you make that magnet move or the wire move is dependent on what fuel you use. But whether you're using coal or nuclear fusion, you're still generating heat in order to make steam, in order to run a turbine, in order to make magnets move. That's it.
Yes, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, that's a heck of a discovery. I mean, but it's really that 10 years, 1820s, 1821, 1831, we get that relationship described of electricity and magnetism, which A, gives us the electric motor, which gives us motion, and B, gives us a way of generating electricity, which basically, that was it. Where would you put Faraday in this pantheon of scientists, Newton and others? I mean, it's hard to imagine the world. I mean, do you think if there was no Faraday, when would we have discovered all this and invented all this? Were others chasing his tail, do you think? Or,
well, I think the experiments would have probably been done later. Maybe how much later, it's hard to say. Well, Faraday's unique contribution is down to Faraday, and would have been really hard for anybody else to follow, is field theory. That was so important in providing a theoretical understanding of the universe. Now, there are two ways of looking at matter. The first is that you've got matter, and out of matter you have lines of force, which is a term that Faraday coined in the 1840s, same time as he coined field theory. Or you have lines of force going into a point, and what you see is the meeting of those lines of force at that point. And Faraday goes down that very anti-materialist interpretation of the world. And I think that's down to his religious beliefs, because the two are actually equivalent, symmetrical opposite of each other. But I think Faraday chose to go down that path because of his belief about the nature of the universe. And I think that's what gave Faraday the edge in developing that very, very powerful theory, which was sort of mathematized by James Clerk Maxwell. And Peter Higgs uses it in his work on the Higgs boson. I mean, it's absolutely fundamental. And I don't think that would have been done by anybody else anytime soon.
Presumably, the fact that the Royal Institution existed, which gave him the space to work, which gave him the freedom to work, led to him being able to do all this.
I mean, one has to say, Faraday being born in, well, there's a pure chance that Faraday was born in London. I mean, his parents came from the Northwest. Had Faraday been born in the Northwest and stayed there, I don't think we would have heard of him, actually.
No. Well, if he'd still been, apparently he was a very good bookbinder. If he'd stuck bookbinding, I wonder, the world may look very different. Frank, while we're on the subject of books, for listeners who want to dive deeper into the world of Faraday and read more, your book is a good place to start, I would say. And it's called?
Michael Faraday, A Very Short Introduction, published, I think, in 2012, 2013. It's only 35,000 words long, so it's not that deep a dive. But
well, listen, Frank, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for an even briefer introduction to Michael Faraday. Although we've probably done 35,000 words, but I'll let people read the book. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time out to chat.
Okay, you're welcome.
So there we go, a lot to get your head around there. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did enjoy, don't forget to go and listen to all the other episodes and hit subscribe or like or whatever it is you have to do. And don't forget to tell all your friends and families and dogs and etc. And don't forget to get in touch if you've got an idea, a subject you'd like us to delve into. You can email us at patented@historykit.com or give me a poke on social media. I have to say, lots of people have poked me on social media and I have a backlog. So if you've poked me and I haven't got back to you, I'm on it soon, I promise.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
While I still have you, very briefly, if you fancy getting all of the History Hit podcast archive and new episodes ad-free, along with hundreds of history documentaries to watch, download our app across Apple App Store, Google Play, and smart TV platforms. Follow the link in the show notes or go to historyhit.com/subscribe. There is thousands of hours of history on there, including a documentary on science in the Middle Ages with Seb Falk, and also one with me talking about the secret history of the space race. As a patented listener, you get a special gift if you use the code PATENTED at the checkout. You get 50% off your first 3 months. That's PATENTED for 50% off your first 3 months. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free podcast episodes within the Apple app.